Morning, ladies and gentlemen. First case for argument this morning is United Stars Industries against Plastic Engineered Products. Mr. Murray.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My client, Plastec, was overbilled for steel tubing it ordered from United because United miscalculated surcharges. Now, United thought it actually underbilled those surcharges. This is a dispute about hundreds of thousands of dollars.
I have a question about the bankruptcy.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is Plastec operating as a debtor in possession or has a trustee been appointed?
They are operating as a debtor in possession, and the scope of the order dealing with the stay makes specific that we are authorized to go forward with the argument. And
no, I understand the stay has been lifted. I just wanted to know whether the current management is continuing as debtor in possession.
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
This is a dispute about hundreds of thousands of dollars on a number of products spanning a number of years and many transactions, all done under written purchase orders. Yet the district court found that the parties settled away all of their differences on nothing more than an email and a phone call, and even agreed to a new long-term supply contract. The district court erred in three ways. First was finding that there was this oral contract. It didn't exist. Second, if there were an oral contract, it should have been enforced on all of its terms, including those favorable to Plastec. And finally, the district court compounded its error by finding that Plastec had first settled away its counterclaim, then excluding all the evidence going to that counterclaim, and ultimately sanctioning Plastec for bringing the counterclaim without admissible evidence. With respect to the oral contract, it's telling that in her opinion, the district court was clear when she said Turton gave his promise that the parties would continue to do business, and there's a record cite there. The second half of the sentence, and that defendant would not seek credit for the alleged overbilling beyond the amount plaintiff had promised to give it, there's no cite, because there is none. The district court's conclusion of an oral contract rested on an email sent by United on July 25th with terms proposed and a phone conversation that happened on August 11th. There are two parts of that phone conversation that the district court concluded were enough to settle away hundreds of thousands of dollars of claims and create a long-term contract. Two statements. The first, that you will not lose the business so long as you continue to perform. Now, that's supported by Plastec's testimony. It is supported by United's president's contemporaneous notes and his testimony. But it has no legal effect. You lose the business as long as you continue to perform. It's puffery. At most, it's a statement that the companies might be considering arriving at new pricing terms going forward, which they ultimately did, and which was ultimately reduced to a new purchase order, consistent with their prior dealings. It's not a statement about credits. The second statement, that Plastec had reviewed the email and the terms were as Mr. Turton would like them to be. Not a statement of I accept these terms. Not a statement of I settle my overbilling claims. It's a statement, I like these terms. That's it. These two things are not the stuff of wiping away an entire course of transactions done on paper for years to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars. There simply was no oral contract.
Your arguments just appear to be the same kind of thing that were already made to the district court. We've had a bench trial. Findings of fact have been made. You're not going anywhere unless you can show us that these are clearly erroneous. We're not going to start from scratch, which is what you're asking now.
I couldn't agree more, Your Honor, but that's exactly the point.
Why are you making the sort of argument you would make to a trier of fact?
The argument I'm trying to make to Your Honors is simply this. Yes, clear error is the standard of review. First of all, in this circuit, where we don't dispute what the facts are, but what really is the legally operative meaning of those facts, there is room for a broader standard of review, a less deferential standard of review, and that's the Royal Business Machines case.
What's the problem with the district court finding that your overbilling claim was packaged into this oral agreement and you agreed to forego it? And that's a finding of fact.
Well, certainly it's a finding of fact, Your Honor, but
what's wrong with it?
What's wrong with it, it goes to this clear error point that Judge Easterbrook brought up. The point is, how do you support that finding? What is the legally operative effect of two statements made on a phone call and an email as between two parties that have worked together for years on lots of dollars and lots of transactions, all done in paper? How can the legally operative effect of these two statements be to create a contract, wiping all of that away? That's the error. I want to embrace the clear error standard. Now, certainly, this court has room to apply a less deferential standard, but I want to embrace clear error. That can't be the stuff of contract. That's not how commercial business operates in this country. It's a clear error question.
Why not? There's a real contract in this case. It's in the year 2000. And then there is, on your view, an oral modification of that contract. The UCC allows oral modification of written contracts. Indeed, I don't know why anybody is talking about a settlement. The way one would think about this under the UCC is this is an oral modification of a written contract. UCC says that's perfectly valid. And so I don't understand what the problem is.
I agree with you, Your Honor, as to the oral modification point you suggest, which is the going forward aspect of what comes out of that phone call. And in fact, that's embodied in, as would not be surprising, a new set of purchase orders. That's exactly what happens when we get into August. We have Plastec sending to United, hey, consistent with this phone call, here is a new set of purchase orders that will govern us going forward, the modification of the contract. This isn't just a battle of the forms. It's not like United just got these and didn't know what to do with them. They made changes to them, sent them back. Plastec then sent them back with the changes, put them in the file. In other words, the parties continued as they always had before, working on paper. What's distinct about this phone call, and no one disputes that, I should add, that the going forward aspect of this was settled out, the oral modification you suggest. It was reduced to a writing. What's distinct about this is what had come before. The credit that was allegedly given wiped away all these years of overbilling in exchange for some period of credits on past invoices. This doesn't deal with a modification going forward. This is the past part. That's what didn't happen in that phone call. The phone call dealt with the going forward only, and that's our position. With respect to our second argument, even if the district court had correctly found that there was this oral settlement agreement, and again, it's our position that there was not, at least that agreement should have been enforced on all of its terms. The district court erred in leaving out two material terms favorable to Plastec. First, the very point of this alleged agreement, the settlement of the credits. There's $197,000 worth of credits minus $35,000 that Plastec had already taken that's not reflected in the judgment. When United sues and says there is an oral settlement agreement, you traded your credits and decided to go forward to settle things, at least we should get the benefit of that alleged bargain. The judgment should at least be reduced by that amount with interest as set forth in our briefs. The second point in which the district court erred was on this liability for raw material purchases. Again, whatever the effect of this conversation, and we believe there was no contract, there were new purchase orders signed following that in the end of August. And that's what the parties continued to do business under. It's at PX 46, these new purchase orders, one of the terms of which, and again, these were sent out by Plastec, marked up by United and sent back, fixed by Plastec and sent back. There's no battle of the forms here. One of the clear terms of this new purchase order, with the new terms of surcharges in it, was that this will be the complete and exclusive statement of our purchase and supply agreement, and it supersedes prior agreements, written or oral. Now, that's important because elsewhere in that purchase order, it says that Plastec shall have no liability for payment for goods ordered by United and or delivered to Plastec that are in excess of quantities specified in the releases. So whatever the content of this alleged oral settlement agreement, it could not have operated to put Plastec on the hook for future damages way out, because the purchase orders that were signed superseded that oral agreement, and the purchase orders that were put in place made very clear that Plastec was not liable for those future damages. Their liability was limited only to releases.
Counsel, as I read the district court's opinion, there was no award for lost profits for future sales. District court didn't say, for example, this guarantees 5 years of sales. I'm figuring out what United Stars would have made over 5 years, discounting it to present value and awarding it. That wasn't done, was it?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. What the district court did do is award damages to United for materials that they had bought, supposedly in reliance on this oral contract. They had gone out and bought steel, which they would then have to cut down and make into tubes. And the district court said, since United could only have used that to make steel tubes for Plastec, Plastec is on the hook for the cost of United having bought that stuff, which may or may not be a normal rule of contract, but it's modified by what the actual written contract that was in place between the parties provided, the purchase orders, which made clear that any liability would not extend to reliance-type damages on the part of United. It would extend only to the quantities actually ordered by Plastec. And for that reason...
And the amount that was authorized by these releases so that United Stars could have steel on hand to meet the orders.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
That's the concrete question I'd like you to address. Was the amount of inventory that the district court ordered to be paid for in excess of the amount that was covered by a release?
It was, Your Honor, and I don't believe there's any dispute as to that. The releases, it should have been limited to quantities that were in the releases as of October 5th of 2005. That's the date United stopped shipping. That means four pieces of this 304 tubing, 525.
No, that's I read that calculation in your brief,
okay.
And that calculation in your brief assumes that releases after this modification were matched against deliveries after this modification.
That's right.
But United Stars is operating 12 weeks in the future because otherwise it can't have the steel on hand. I'm interested in the whole history, that is, all the releases, not just the releases after the date of this modification.
I understand, and I'm sorry if that was unclear, Your Honor. What we're doing, what we tried to do in that calculation is set out all of the outstanding invoices that had not, I'm sorry, the outstanding releases that had not been fulfilled by United by the time that they stopped shipping. United stopped shipping in October of 2005. At that point, there had been issued by Plastec certain releases going out into the future.
Right. So you say that calculation in your brief deals with all the releases for the entire history of the contract.
All of the releases that had been issued by Plastec for the entire history of the contract. It's a reconciliation of what was left when United stopped shipping. And with that, if liability is limited to only those things that Plastec had actually ordered, rather than materials above and beyond that that the district court held were properly awardable, that too would significantly reduce the damages. Again, on a $1.2 or $3 million judgment, we're talking a total of $440,000 or so dollars between these two errors. These are significant. If there was an oral contract, at least Plastec should get the benefit of whatever it was supposed to have bargained for. Which brings me to my last point, which are these sanctions against Jones Day. 1927, as your honors know, is an exceedingly high standard. It is sparingly applied, and it is strictly construed. There has never been a finding in this case that any individual authorized to practice law before the Western District of Wisconsin engaged in any conduct that was both unreasonable.
Jones Day make such an argument in the district court? When was the first time an argument was made that the 1927 sanction can't be against an entity as opposed to a person?
And I just want to be clear, Judge Easterbrook, we're not making the argument in those terms today. There was some of that in motion practice before the district court. She actually entered a separate opinion dealing with agency.
That means you certainly make this argument in your brief. Are you abandoning it now?
No. What I want to say is I want to be clear. I understand that's how United has characterized our argument. Our point is not the question of whether a law firm qua law firm can be sanctioned. Our question...
Look, then you are abandoning it.
Yes.
You're abandoning the argument in your brief.
I am not making that argument before the court today.
No, that's not what I'm asking.
To the extent
are you waiving that argument?
To the extent our brief is read to make that argument, I'm waiving it, yes. Our point is not that a law firm can't be sanctioned. Our point is that on this record, there is no evidence of any lawyer associated with Jones Day doing...
Why, if you now allow that the sanction can be against the law firm as an entity, why does the district court have to make a finding about a particular lawyer? Most of these documents that the district court complained about are signed by at least two lawyers. If the sanction can be against the entity, why would the district court have to find which of the two lawyers was responsible for the frivolous document?
And again, I want to be clear. I'm not making an argument about which lawyer did what. What I want to make the point of is that what the district court found, even if you allow for a law firm to be held liable, what the district court found is not enough to impose liability. It has to be both unreasonable, and it's not a matter of findings. It's a matter of what is in the record. It has to be both unreasonable and vexatious. And we're talking about three limited things. This is not studied course of conduct over a lawsuit like most of the 1927 opinions read. We're talking about three very specific things. The first was maintaining our counterclaim for overbilling. What the district court did here was to find that it was baseless because it was unsupported by admissible evidence. Of course, she excluded all of that evidence during trial. If this were the standard for awarding sanctions, then going to trial and losing becomes 1927 sanctionable. That is not the law. There was a good faith basis in law and fact to bring in to maintain this counterclaim. That she excluded the evidence and we lost is not a basis for sanctions. Losing is different than being vexatious. With respect to this motion in limine, again, this is a point covered extensively in the briefs. The point is this. Plastec bought one motion in limine because the whole point of this case is these surcharges, which involve a simple computation on its face of a rate times a weight. United has said from day one, we've told you that the weight is 0.623. We've told you what this rate is. You could do division and math and figure out the rest. We don't disagree that they gave us that, but our motion in limine wasn't about that. Our motion in limine was, why these numbers? And that was some of the evidence we had. What brought this whole case on was we had found out, Plastec found out from another supplier, that the weight of these tubes was not 0.623. It was something like 0.52. That was the basis of the overbilling claim. Now, again, that evidence was excluded. But that was the basis of the motion in limine.
You should be thanking your lucky stars, not complaining about this award. Judge Crabb almost never awards sanctions. Jones Day pushed her over the edge in this case, and even so, she could have awarded four or five times the amount that she did. Do you want us to remand and ask Judge Crabb to recalculate in a way that the sanctions might go up?
No, of course not, Your Honor. What I'd like for the court to do is overturn the sanctions award in reverse. What happened here was not unreasonable. It was grounded in law and fact.
Look, I can go back to where I began. The standard of review is abuse of discretion. You're not arguing abuse of discretion to us. You're asking us to make a de novo judgment. And, you know, those kinds of arguments go nowhere on appeal.
I appreciate that, Your Honor, but I want to be clear. I'm not asking the court to make a de novo judgment. I'm asking the court to look at the record and see what happened. This is a case of a judge who did exactly what this court's decisions in Knorr say she's not supposed to do. Hindsight adjudication of what happened at trial based on what evidence got admitted at trial and how things came through at trial. That is not a basis for saying that these arguments were not well-grounded in law and fact when made. That's exactly what a district court judge cannot do under this court's clear precedence. There was no basis for sanctions here, and I would argue that it was, in fact, an abuse of discretion to hold otherwise. Not only was there no basis for finding that there was anything unreasonable, there was no basis for finding there was anything unjustified. This is a whole separate finding. There was no such finding. I mean, as Judge Easterbrook put it, that Judge Crabb felt she was pushed. That's something different. This has to be conduct by a lawyer that is a studied disregard for the respect for the judicial process. It has to be not just non-grounded in fact and law. That's not enough. It has to be without justification. There was no finding as to that. There can be no finding as to that. It was hard-fought litigation. It went through trial. Plastec lost. That's one thing. To add on to that the insult of saying, and now Jones Day must be sanctioned because Plastec lost, that is not the law. That is an abuse of discretion. With respect, I reserve my time.
Mr. Murray. Ms. Sable.
May it please the Court. My name is Diane Sable, and I represent United Stars Industries, Inc. We are here today because Plastec ordered over $800,000 worth of stainless steel tubing from United.
What's the status of the bankruptcy? And I'm particularly interested, again, not in whether the automatic stay has been lifted. Obviously it has. But what are the size of Plastec's debts in the bankruptcy?
Your Honor,
is this a judgment you expect to collect, or are their debts grossly in excess of their liabilities?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of their debts, but I can tell you that we have a bond in this matter that secures the judgment.
So they posted a supersedious bond.
Right, in order to stay the litigation from collection.
Mm-hmm.
As I was saying, we are here today because Plastec ordered over $800,000 worth of stainless steel tubing from United over 2 years ago, and it is still not paid. After a three-day trial, the court found that the parties reached a settlement agreement. And under that agreement, Plastec was required to pay United for the tubing that it ordered and shipped. This is not a case about underbillings or overbillings or the calculation of surcharge. Those issues were all resolved by the settlement agreement. The court's findings that the parties entered into a binding settlement agreement is only reviewed for clear error. The evidence overwhelmingly supports that finding. Contrary to Mr. Murray's assertion, the court's finding was not based on two sentences and an email. The court's findings was based on a phone conversation that's largely undisputed, an assessment of credibility. Both United's and Plastic's actions that were taken after that phone call that demonstrated the parties were performing under that agreement, and the fact that Plastic took $35,000 of the credit, which Mr. Turton testified was only given, offered by United to resolve the outstanding issue, which was the overbilling. The court also properly enforced the settlement agreement. The court did not selectively enforce the terms of that agreement. Before United Plastic breached the agreement by failing to pay for the tubing it ordered and by canceling its future shipments with United, Plastic received $35,000 of the credit, received discounted prices, and also received a release of United's underbilling claims. When the court enforced the judgment after Plastic materially, the agreement, after Plastic materially breached that agreement, it did not require Plastic to return the $35,000 of the credit it had obtained. It did not require Plastic to repay the discounted prices, and it did not require Plastic to pay the underbilling claims. Instead, because Plastic's breach destroyed the essence of the contract, and because United will never be fully compensated for its breach of Plastic's future commitment to long-term purchasing, the court correctly did not require United to pay Plastic the remainder of the credit. Once a party materially breaches, subsequent performance can be excused. And that finding is reviewed for clear error. The court also did not err when she found that United was entitled to damages for the losses it incurred on the raw materials it had on hand and finished goods it had on hand when Plastic canceled its orders.
The contract says that there isn't any obligation for raw materials other than those covered by the releases. And Mr. Murray says that they've calculated how much was covered by releases, but that United Stars was seeking and got damages for amounts of inventory of raw materials, that were beyond those that were subject to the release. What's your understanding of that calculation? Is that true or not?
First of all, the assumption that the calculation based on is wrong. United didn't terminate the agreement on October 5th. Plastic breached the agreement on October 19th when it canceled its orders with United going forward.
Could you address my question, please?
I'm not aware of the calculation, the exact calculation of the scheduled releases after October 5th. I know that Mr. Murray's argument, though, is based on the calculations as of October 5th. I can tell you, though, that under the terms of the settlement agreement, which the parties were operating under, not the terms of the purchase agreement, Plastic called United on several occasions to make sure it had sufficient materials on hand to provide a continuous supply of tubing to Plastic. It checked that it had the right materials that it was purchasing. It can't now claim by an inconsistent term in the boilerplate language of the purchase order.
No, I don't think you get anywhere by denouncing boilerplate. That things get to be called boilerplate because they're very useful and parties find it worthwhile to use it over and over. And this contract says no liability for raw material orders other than those covered by a written release. That's why I'm asking whether the district court awarded damages for raw materials beyond those covered by written releases.
And I'm not sure, Your Honor. I can tell you, though, that that's not the term.
I'm not sure. Your adversary makes this one of their main points on appeal. Now, I would have thought that this is a subject you need to be prepared to answer.
Well, Your Honor, the terms of the agreement were not the terms of the purchase order. Plastic's argument is trying to undo a three-day trial where the The court found that the parties were operating under the terms of the settlement agreement. Take, for example, the credit. If the purchase orders were the operating terms of this agreement, Plastic would not have been able to short pay earlier invoices. The only reason they were able to do that was because the terms of the settlement agreement applied here. And under the terms of the settlement agreement, United was expected to have a continuous supply of tubing. They had to purchase 12 weeks out, and they had to purchase beyond sometimes what the scheduled releases called for. The court found that United relied on Plastic's representations that it was going to agreement that it was going to purchase long term from Plastic, from United. And because of that reliance, it was left with goods that it had to sell for a loss, and under the UCC is entitled to those incidental damages. The court also properly sanctioned Jones Day for its conduct in this case. Jones Day was not sanctioned for being on the losing side of this argument, as it claims. It was sanctioned for a course of conduct throughout the litigation that demonstrated a disregard for the court's standing orders, the court's rules, as well as unreasonable and vexatious multiplication of the proceedings. The court focused only on the three most egregious examples of this conduct. There was a whole host of other conduct throughout the litigation that demonstrated the disregard for the court's rules. First, they were sanctioned.
I'm now lost. You're not suggesting that we affirm the award of sanctions on subjects A, B, and C on the ground that the district court denied sanctions on subjects D, E, and F, are you?
No, I'm merely stating that.
Then issues beyond what the court awarded sanctions on are just not relevant. They would be relevant if you'd filed a cross-appeal, but you didn't.
Yes, Your Honor. The court did award sanctions against Jones Day for the counterclaim that it filed, and it awarded those sanctions not because it lost the counterclaim, but because it knew well in advance of trial that there were no facts to support that claim. The court instead found that the evidence demonstrated overwhelmingly that Plastic had sufficient information to know exactly what United was charging it and how the surcharges were calculated. For example, Jones Day was well aware before the trial began that United informed Plastic of the weight that it used to calculate its surcharges. It was also well aware that before trial, that United told Plastic the surcharge rate it used to calculate the surcharges, and that the surcharge rate was always published on United's website. With those two pieces of information, Plastic could have calculated its surcharges at any time and could have comparison shopped. In fact, that's exactly what it did in 2005. Additionally, the lawyers were well aware in advance of trial that United informed Plastic that it used a higher surcharge rate than the published mill surcharge that was published by the published mill surcharge, by the published mill. In 2002, United sent an email to Plastic informing them that they did not pass through the published mill surcharge and that it was increased to account for scrap. Plastic did not object. Instead, it continued purchasing from United for well over 3 years. Despite this evidence, Jones Day pursued with the counterclaim. Finally, they also point to Liz Pippa's testimony, that the court didn't properly consider Liz Pippa's testimony. That's not the case. Liz Pippa actually testified that Paul Kleinsmith of United informed her that the surcharges would also be charged on other elements besides nickel. She admitted that surcharges could be issued on molybdenum, as well as on ferrochrome. Despite this information, Jones Day pursued a counterclaim where it informed the district court that the parties only agreed to have surcharges on nickel. It is this disregard of all the evidence and still pursuing a counterclaim that Jones Day was sanctioned for, not for losing. As is detailed in her briefs, the court also properly excluded Exhibit 619 as well as Maria Houghton's deposition testimony, because they were both unreliable, and Jones Day knew that well in advance of trial. Jones Day was also sanctioned for a default motion that it a default defense that it raised on the eve of trial. This defense contradicted its previous admissions that it had made in its answer. And additionally, the default defense had no evidence to support it. Despite the fact that Jones Day knew the defense contradicted its own binding admissions, and that there was no evidence to support a default, that Plastic was actually the party that had canceled, breached by canceling its orders and by failing to pay for the product it ordered, it pursued that defense anyway, and that's why it was sanctioned. Finally, in the motion in limine, Jones Day made misrepresentations. They misrepresented that United never produced the calculated weight formula. They claim on appeal that they never made those misrepresentations. But our brief points out seven quotes in which the motion in limine states that United never produced that formula. They then say, well, we explained everything to the court in oral argument. We explained it was really because United couldn't explain the underlying basis of that formula. Well, that's not true either. But simply because they backed away once they got caught, it doesn't change the fact that they made misrepresentations to the court and forced United to incur the time and expense just days before trial addressing baseless and false assertions. The assertion that United could not explain the underlying basis of the formula is also misrepresentation. Mr. Arana questioned John Robb for over 10 pages in his deposition on that formula. Mr. Robb answered every single question. Mr. Arana never indicated that he didn't get a sufficient answer. It was Mr. Arana that moved on from the topic. And to claim still on appeal that United could not explain the underlying basis of the formula just demonstrates why it was appropriate for the court to issue sanctions in this case. For the reasons stated in our brief and here today, we respectfully request that this court affirm the judgments.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Murray?
May it please the court, three brief points in rebuttal. One, we just heard counsel talk about this formula question. The bottom line on the formula is, yes, there's some division and stuff that goes on. The question is not, did they give us the numbers? Sure, they gave us numbers. The question is, why the numbers? Defendant's Exhibit 521 is a spreadsheet. It's the most detail we ever got. It's a bunch of numbers that have multiplications in an Excel format. I, to this day, standing here, don't know what these are. At a minimum, that was our point in the motion in limine. If they can't tell us any better than that, how they're calculating these surcharges, why are we having a trial? Second, on the sanctions point, again, what we're hearing is Jones Day knew evidence wouldn't be admitted. I mean, that's not the standard. We can't know when evidence is going to be admitted. Evidence was excluded, and we lost. There's a difference between losing and being sanctionable. Section 1927 doesn't permit the sort of backfilling that went on here. Again, remember the sequence. Judge Crabb issued sanctions against Plastec, saying that what happened was not okay, again, without specific findings. She then subbed in Jones Day when counsel pointed out that you can't award 1927 sanctions against a client. And even here today, there's more backfilling attempted with, no, there were actually eight things on the table. Again, all of that is irrelevant. Look at the three things. Look at what happened. These are not the stuff of 1927 sanctions.
Can you just go back to the bankruptcy for a moment?
Yes, Your Honor.
How many creditors are there?
I don't have a full sense of that. There are creditors. There is a supersedes bond in this case.
If after 10:30 this morning you went out in the hall and settled this case, whoever issued the supersedious bond from any responsibility, would that be a voidable preference by the other creditors?
As I understand it, that's actually I don't know the answer as I stand here. It exceeds my knowledge of bankruptcy law. I assume if people could challenge it as a preference. Whether it would be, I don't know, since there is a bond in place.
You can always relieve the bond. That's a deal between you and the bonding company that's approved by the court to withhold any execution on the judgment while this appeal is taking place.
I suppose if that happened, it could be challenged, but I don't know how that would go. The bankruptcy is in the Eastern District of Michigan. My last point, Your Honors, if I could briefly, Judge Easterbrook has focused on this future materials, future needs point. I would just point out that United didn't dispute anywhere in its brief that our calculation is right, that in fact damages were awarded in excess of the releases. And with respect to the credits being some sort of subsequent performance that could be excused, I mean, again, what's alleged is that was the very reason we settled this thing in the first place. Thank you, Your Honors.
Case is taken under advisement.